If you'd been a Christian back in 1804, would you have sided with the lying Baptist or the truthful Baptist? Now, what do I mean by that? Well, the lying Baptists were folks out on the western frontier who said, if we are captured by the Indians and if they ask us if we have any children, we would lie and say no in order to protect our children. Now, the truthful Baptist said, under no circumstances should we ever lie, even if it puts our children in jeopardy. Now, you and I know that we are to be truth-tellers, that we are not to break the ninth commandment, but sometimes it's difficult, isn't it? Now, take those doctors in an article in the Baltimore Sun who said that it was acceptable to lie to the insurance companies when only a lie would produce the kind of medical care that was needed by their patients who could not afford it. Now, I don't know about you, but my sympathies kind of lie with the doctors, and they kind of lie with the lying Baptists. I think if my children or my grandchildren's lives were at stake, I would certainly be tempted to tell a lie in order to protect them. But you know what? A lie is a lie. And it's still sin, you know? If I lived back in Nazi Germany during World War II and I was confronted by the SS, and if they asked me if I was hiding Jews in my home, and I was, I'm fairly certain that I'd say no. But then I go and have to confess to God because a lie is a lie and it's sin. And lying is a slippery slope. You know, the first time you do it, it makes it that much easier to do it again and again and again. This evening, we're in the 15th chapter of 1 Samuel. Here's a situation where God has orchestrated a tremendous military victory for Israel over the Amalekites. As part of the victory, God has told King Saul to annihilate the Amalekites. Men, women, children, animals, possessions, they were to obliterate the Amalekites from off the face of the earth. Now, the Amalekites had harassed and pillaged the Israelites ever since Israel had first come into the Holy Land. But, you know, come on, God, you know, wipe them all out, Saul balks, and you and I balk, don't we? And, you know, you and I balk when we confront a text like the one we're going to read. The text that we're about to look at challenges the socks off of us, and I mean the faith socks. You know, here we seem to encounter a vengeful, cruel, ruthless God who demands the annihilation of a group of people. And I don't know about you, but for me, this text certainly threatens that desire that I have, that deep down desire that I have to have a God who is comfortable, domesticated, housebroken, manageable, a God who is all warm and fuzzy, that has no wrath. But unfortunately, you can search the Scriptures from cover to cover and you don't find a God like that. And so we are confronted by this text and others in the Scripture with some options on how to deal with a God like this. And one option is that you and I can just become atheists and we can just walk away from that type of God. You know? Or secondly, and probably the most popular approach to a text like this is to say, oh man, that's just a whacked out Old Testament, you know? It's just an Old Testament story. Let's just stay here in the New Testament, you know, and deal with the stories here. And so we throw it out and begin to fashion a God who's more like our liking then. Now there's a third option, is to confront a text like this and tenaciously try to hold on to it in tension with the supremacy of God. We also see in Scriptures that are revealed then that about Jesus Christ, and to hope that somehow, beyond our limited, finite, sinful perspective, a text like this is not analytical to the love and the grace and the mercy of God. You know, and I would propose that the third option is the only one that is truly faithful, the only one I try to practice in my own life when I'm confronted with a text like this is, but you know what? We have also got to come clean with ourselves and say that oftentimes when we find ourselves revolted by a certain text of Scripture, we oftentimes use that as a smokescreen. to not really deal with the clear commands of God in our lives. You know, the commands to you and me may not be as bloody as slaughtering the Amalekites. But sometimes they are every bit as distasteful to us, and they're uncomfortable and they're difficult because they require for us to make a change or alter our course or do something completely different than what we want to do. And so they become very tough for us. And the issue before us is really obedience and truth-telling. You know, our character, not God's character, is on the line. And you take anything from this sermon this evening, the point of this text is that partial obedience equals disobedience. So let's tackle this text head on. We're in chapter 15, 1 Samuel 15, verses 10 through 16. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel, "I am grieved that I have made Saul king, because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions." Samuel was troubled, and he cried out to the Lord all that night. Early in the morning, Samuel got up and went to meet Saul. But he was told, "Saul has gone to Carmel. There he has set up a monument in his own honor and has turned and gone on down to Gilgal." When Samuel reached him, Saul said, "The Lord bless you. I've carried out the Lord's instructions." But Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of sheep in my ears? What is this lowing of cattle that I hear?" Saul answered, "The soldiers brought them, the Amalekites. They spared the best of the sheep and cattle to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but we totally destroyed the rest." "Stop," Samuel said to Saul. "Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night." "Tell me," Saul replied. Friends, I think verse 11 here of our text has simply got to be one of the saddest verses in all of the Scriptures. You know, after this great military victory by the Israelites, all the Amalekites, we are allowed to peer into the very heart of God here. And as God pours out His heart here to His prophet Samuel, and He says, "I am sorry, sorry that I ever made Saul king. He has not obeyed me." Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel, "I am grieved that I've made Saul king, because he has turned away from me and he has not carried out my instructions." And here verse 11 transports you and me all the way back to Genesis, the 6th chapter, where God at the time of Noah looks at this rebellious humankind and He says, "You know, I'm sorry that I ever created them." And we are transported down to the base of Mount Sinai in Exodus, the 32nd chapter, where God looks upon the idolatry of the Israelites when they fashion the golden calf. And again, this emotion erupts from God's heart. And He says, "I am sorry that I brought them out of Egypt." And Samuel's troubled. He's up all night with God. He's wrestling with God. Pleading really for the life of Saul here. And by the way, if you're here this evening and you're a believer in Jesus Christ, that's exactly what Jesus is doing for you and me day in and day out, night and day, in the wake of our rebellion, our lives of partial obedience. Jesus intercedes for you and me. And He stands in the gap. He stands between us and the wrath of God. And that is sheer grace. You know, Samuel intercedes for Saul. Christ intercedes for you and me. And let's move on here, though. Samuel, after a sleepless night, sets out to track down Saul, which is a difficult thing to do. Saul is all over the map now, all over the countryside, proclaiming this great military victory about the things that he has accomplished. You know, and so Samuel tracks him down to Carmel. He's not there. Oh, but he's left something in the wake. Here in verse 12, it says, "Early in the morning, Samuel got up and went to meet Saul, but he was told, 'Saul has gone to Carmel. There he has set up a monument in his own honor and has turned and gone on down to Gilgal.'" Here in verse 12, you and I get a picture of what life looks like when it becomes unhooked from God. You know, Saul's all over the place. He's not only believing his press clippings about himself, but he actually erects a monument to himself. You know, now the pagan kings of that era erected monuments to themselves, for one primary reason, and that was to proclaim that they were deity. And when you and I, like King Saul, choose to go our own way, do our own thing rather than God things, when we get confused, we begin to confuse who we are in our relationship to who God is. And when you and I go our own way, what we're really doing is placing our personal authority over and above God's authority, and therefore ipso facto playing God. We began to confuse ourselves with being God. And there's a problem here because the universe is only big enough for one God. I like the three guys who were in a mental institution for the fact that they had a Messiah complex. One day a psychiatrist met with the three as a group, and one of the patients began jumping up and down saying, "You know, I am the Messiah. I am the Son of God. You know, I have been sent on a mission, and the mission is to save the earth." And the psychiatrist looked at him in the eye and he said, "Well, who told you this?" And he replied, "God did." At which point one of the other patients said, "I most certainly never said such a thing as that." You know? You see, when you and I do our thing and clearly disregard God's thing, life gets very confusing. The primary point of the story is this, that partial obedience equals disobedience. Verse 13, when Samuel reached him, Saul said, "The Lord bless you. I've carried out the Lord's instruction." Samuel finally catches up with Saul, who's on this big trip. And Saul's no dummy, of course. Saul knows that he's not carried out God's instruction to wipe out all the Amalekites. He knows that Samuel is a prophet and probably suspects something. And Saul knows that the best defense is a good offense. So note that when Samuel meets up with Saul, Saul is doing all the talking. "Hey, Samuel, good to see you. You know, you are a guy who walks the right road. Glad you are here. I want you to know I've carried out all the Lord's commandments to the T." Which, of course, was a lie. Now, I didn't include it here as part of our text, but verse 9 says, "Saul and his army let Agag live, and they also spared the best sheep and cattle. They didn't want to destroy anything of value, so they only killed the animals that were worthless or weak." Because, you know, here we see just what a big liar Saul is, you know. Not only has Saul not wiped the Amalekites, he's kept a little trophy for himself, you know, called Agag, who is the king of the Amalekites. So why not? You know, you ever heard of a trophy wife? Why not a trophy king? You know? Someone you can lead around on a leash like this, you know? And not only that, he didn't wipe out all the booty. And no, we are told that he's even saved the best cattle and sheep. And not only that, if you jumped over to 1 Samuel chapter 30, and you look at verse 1, you see there that years later the bands of Amalekites, remember they were supposed to destroy all of them, bands of Amalekites at the end of 1 Samuel are roaming the countryside causing all kinds of trouble. Trouble that would not have happened if Saul would have been obedient. No, Saul tells these lies here to cover up his disobedience. He was partially obedient, but partial obedience equals disobedience. And so Saul goes into creating his whole system of lies. Now, C.S. Lewis once said that a little lie is like a little pregnancy. Pretty soon, everyone knows about it. No? And the truth is sort of like a beach ball in a pool. You know, ever had a beach ball in the pool and you push it down under the water and you try to keep it under the water? Well, the truth is like that beach ball. Pretty soon it pops up. No matter how many ways we try to disguise the truth, pretty soon it pops up. One of my favorite short stories and very appropriate for this is Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart. Maybe you had to read that sometime. And maybe you got to read that sometime. I think it's a good read, a good story. But in that story, Poe tells about a murderer The guy murders an old man who's been driving and crazy. And he dismembers the body, and then he tears up the floorboards, and he buries the body, and he puts the floorboards back in place. And he is convinced in his own mind that he has committed the perfect crime. And but there was a scream heard when he killed the old man, so the police show up the next day to investigate. And again, confident that he's pulled off the perfect crime, the murderer invites the police in, shows them all around the house. He asks them to stay. He entertains them. He engages them with this lighthearted banter. And everything is just going great until suddenly, boom, 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 boom. He begins to hear the old man's heartbeat. How can it be? I know he's dead. Maybe it's just in my own head. Can the police hear this? And he becomes convinced that they can. And now they're toying with me. They are acting like they can't hear it. And he breaks down and he confesses right there that he is the murderer. Well, verse 14 of our text is right out of Edgar Allan Poe. But Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears, that the lowing of the oxen which I hear?" Our text, again, right out of Edgar Allan Poe's, right out of the Three Stooges almost. You know, Samuel comes to Saul, and Saul's rambling on and on about how he's carried out the Lord's orders to the T, how he's wiped out all the people, all the animals, not even a little lamb is left. Samuel will wipe them all out. "You should have been there. It was so great. I mean, not even a little hamster was left. Samuel, you got to believe me. I really did what God asked." It reminds me of the story of Tony Campola. He tells about one time when he was invited to preach in a church in all places, Las Vegas. There's a place that could use a lot of preaching, I suppose. But they put him up in one of the casino hotels. And Sunday morning he was told to wait down in the lobby and that a deacon would come by and pick him up and take him on out to church to preach. And so he got down there early and he was just standing in the lobby kind of waiting, you know, fidgeting, waiting for the deacon to show up. And he put his hand in his pocket and lo and behold, there was one long quarter in his pocket. Now, Campolo is not a gambler, but he thought to himself, "Now I may never get back to Las Vegas again. What the heck?" And so he goes over to the slot machine and he puts the quarter in. He pulls the arm back. He hits the jackpot. And quarters come pouring out all over the floor. Campolo says he shoveled them in his briefcase, and when that was full, he put them in his pants pocket. And when that was full, he began to put them in his suit coat pockets, until his suit was hanging down. He gets them all put away, and the deacon walks in. And Campolo said he was jingling and jangling his way to the car, and the deacon looked back at him. He said, "You haven't been gambling, have you?" Well, when you're caught red-handed, when you're cornered, it's best to fess up, right? Well, not if you're King Saul. Look at verse 15. "Saul answered, 'The soldiers brought them the Amalekites. They spared the best of the sheep and the cattle to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but we totally destroyed the rest.'" Well, that verse transports us all the way back to the Garden of Eden, doesn't it? Where everybody got blamed for what happened there, and what happened in that rebellious situation is that partial obedience is complete disobedience. And now the buck has landed on Saul's desk. "Samuel, it was the soldiers brought these sheep and lambs back and the cattle. Besides, it was for a good cause. But we brought the sheep and the cattle back so that they could be sacrificed. Yeah, we could sacrifice them to the Lord." And then watch this Freudian slip out of Saul's tongue. Saul answered the soldiers, brought them the Amalekites. They spared the best of the sheep and cattle to sacrifice to the Lord your God. But we totally destroyed the rest. The Lord your God. Here Saul listened to what God says to the prophet Hosea. In chapter 6 of Hosea, he says, I delight in loyalty, that is obedience, not in the sacrifice. In verse 15, Saul is saying a lot more here than he realizes, because you see, when you and I do our own thing rather than God's thing, we find out just what Saul found. That as you go down that track, God becomes Samuel's God and not Saul's God. Saul is his own God. He has got the monument now to prove it. Shut up, says Samuel. Stop, said Samuel to Saul. Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. Look, I was up all night because of you. And the Lord was giving me an earful. And you want to hear it? And still searching for that escape hatch, still hiding behind that kingly bravado, still convinced that he can somehow pull this over at Samuel and over on God. Samuel says, you know, sure, tell me, far away, I have all my ears. Are not big enough ears to hear the voice of God when he shouts. And how about our ears? Do we hear what God says to us? Do we respond? Do we respond in to some of what God says? Partial obedience is disobedience. Let our response be total